policy, but questions we have this evening. Oh, okay. From my limited understanding, when the constriction of self drops away in meditation, there is joy and peace. This makes me think that deep insight into anatta might be profoundly blissful. I'm having trouble seeing how the same would be true for dukkha and anicca. Can you help? Well, the thing is that that insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta is basically it's the same insight. So that, I mean, it has a slightly different manifestation or how it is either seen or experienced, but the insight is really inextricably linked to each other, so that that which is impermanent is inevitably impossible to be completely satisfying all the time. That which is changing, unsatisfying, is not self. And that's a very broad brush, but the that insight into not self is not fundamentally different than insight into anicca or dukkha. So in the same way that they say an insight, deep insight into anatta is, say, profoundly blissful, so is an insight into anicca, in the sense of that, oh, this is really the way it is. This is the truth of inconstancy, of change, of instability, and I don't have to. I don't have to struggle with it anymore. It's this way. Or in the same with dukkha, I'm sort of seeing, oh, this is unsatisfactory. This is stressful. That's the way it is. Oh, wow, that's a relief. And it's just it isn't sort of, oh, this is dukkha. Oh, that really sucks. You know? It's real. Wow, that's really, that's the way it is, and so that the heart really opens up to it, and it is profoundly, you know, kind of relieved. There's a burden taken off the heart when we see things in their true nature, so that anicca, dukkha, anatta are all expressions of basically the same truth, seen from different angles. I often find it hard to stay settled on the breath. Though I've been meditating for some time, my mind does not seem to focus well. When things are quote-unquote going well, I feel a sense of joy, but my mind jumps from topic to topic quickly, as though excited it's going well. And therein lies the tale. When things aren't going well, my mind shifts into work mode, trying to fix the situation and bring the joy back. This results in a lot of tension in my face and long, difficult sittings. Do you have any advice? I just try to relax a bit. Relax and enjoy the practice. You know, it's that, because oftentimes, I mean, the thing is we're, we actually are committed to practice. Learn to trust yourself, because we are committed. We are, you know, we're highly motivated, and sometimes that gets in the way. Just being too motivated, too dutiful, too concerned with the details, and just learn how to relax into the practice, and then you'll start to balance yourself anyway, because there's that sense that there's a commitment to that training already. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. But there is a tendency to make it more burdensome than it needs to be. Reminds me of an Ajahn Chah story. One time when Ajahn Sumedho had gone to England to establish the monasteries there, and when Ajahn Chah took Ajahn Sumedho to England and the first time, and when Ajahn Chah came back to Thailand, he told Ajahn Sumedho, stay here for 5 years, don't come back to Thailand. And so he took that seriously, and as much as he missed Thailand, missed Ajahn Chah, then he waited for 5 years and then made plans to come for a visit to Thailand. So then people started to hear about him coming. Some people joined him, and one person who was a sculptor wanted to send a gift to Ajahn Chah through Ajahn Sumedho, and so that he made a sculpture of, say, a Buddha image, a Buddha statue, and then it was about that high, and so Ajahn Sumedho, when he arrived and paid respects, and then he opened up this gift and offered it to Ajahn Chah, and then Ajahn Chah set it on a little table next to him. And the image was of a meditating Buddha, but kind of very upright, like that, you know, very upright. And Ajahn Chah, and the word for a Westerner is a furung in Thai. So then Ajahn Chah sort of came, from time to time he'd sort of look, he was chatting with Ajahn Sumedho and the others were there. From time to time he'd look over and see this image, and then finally he smiled, and he said, that's really a furung Buddha. He said, look how tense he is. that sense of getting that balance of relaxing and being diligent. And so we have to play with that, work with that. But I think one of the things to actually really trust yourself. Thank you for this opportunity to practice and your guidance. Can you explain Nirodha? Nirodha is the term normally translated as cessation, ceasing, so that oftentimes it's a synonym for Nibbana, so like Dukkha Nirodha, so the cessation of Dukkha. And also seen as a part of the goal in terms of say, like in the Anapanasati Sutta, the second last factor is, say, contemplating cessation, I breathe in, contemplating cessation, I breathe out. And it has a a problematic nature in terms of just how we express it in language, in the sense of ending, cessation, because it oftentimes we think, and similar, say, like dependent origination, there's that the arising mode and the ceasing mode, and of course the say bringing the different factors of dependent origination to cessation mode is certainly a goal. But the tendency to how the mind relates to cessation is that we conceive of something as already existing, and then we have to end it, stop it, make it cease. And that's a problem, because we get busy. We get obsessed with something. I got to get rid of that. This has got to end. So, say, especially, and you think in terms of the, teaching on dependent origination, so that when, ignorance ceases, then formations cease. When formations cease, consciousness ceases. We'll assume that we got to go around stamping out ignorance and stamping out formations and bringing it to an end. But an equally valid translation is, or way of phrasing it, is when ignorance ceases to be a problem, formation ceases to be a problem. When formation ceases to be a problem, and so then in the same way, becoming ceases to be a problem, then birth, aging, sickness, and death cease to be a problem. It's we don't make problems anymore. So that's an important way of holding it, because we can release around that. We can, and that's the say in thinking in terms of the say like the instructions that the Buddha gives in mindfulness of breathing. Following on from Nirodha, from cessation, is relinquishment, so that that forms a suitable basis for relinquishment and release. And I know that it has the same. I remember a monk in Thailand talking about it, a scholar, a Pali scholar, and this is a similar problem in the Thai language as well. Sometimes in Thai language, then it becomes a lot clearer, because they've been using Pali for millennia, and it's incorporated into the language. But in this case, I think it's a human problem. That sense of how we use language, how we conceive of things. But just expanding the way we conceive of it, then it takes on a much more appropriate Dhamma meaning. Does a Sotapanna, Magga or Pala, keep the precepts perfectly? Classic definition of a Sotapanna or a stream enterer is that their virtue is unstained, unmottled, unbesmirched. I mean, that their precepts are kept perfectly. But it's also in that iteration of that, it's also that the precepts form a basis for freedom from doubt and for concentration. So it isn't as if they're desperately or rigidly trying to hold the precepts perfectly. It's an expression of their being that the precepts aren't transgressed, because the heart is really clear and stable. Could you speak on working with sanya in meditation or perception? Over these days, there is an experience of heightened sensitivity to perception and the initial contact that gives rise to thought / feeling. In particular, I notice how an inaccurate perception seen as inaccurate gives rise to thought formations that move forward as if based on an accurate perception. This moves fast in the mind and feels somewhat trippy and disorienting. How does one develop the skill of sensitivity to perception so as to have durability in daily life? Yeah, I mean, the way that what one perceives, one thinks about. So that's a kind of a stock phrase in several suttas. So that the that process of perception moves the mind to its thought formations, and it doesn't actually care whether they're accurate or inaccurate. It's just keep me going. So it's that's why it's so important to be attentive to dukkha, because that's an indication when there's dukkha, when there's stress, when there's a feeling of discomfort, dis-ease, when it feels there's signs, the feedback is starting to get signs of, okay, something's amiss here. So then that's where one utilizes these Four Noble Truths in very ordinary situations in order to help kind of clarify, okay, what works, what doesn't work, in terms of a, because perceptions can be accurate or inaccurate. You can have an inaccurate perception and still end up doing something quite nice and satisfying. So it's really attuning to the result, and then one's able to work through how's that process work, because it's the way the mind works, and that feeling, perception, mental formation. Okay. I have found your teachings on renunciation and metta extremely fruitful. Please talk more, especially about fixed views and nine conceits. It's giving me more to do. Giving me more to do here. I think one of the things because views and conceits are two different words. In Pali, view is ditti, like having views, fixed views, and conceit is mana. And the Buddha points to three things that complicate the mind or proliferate the mind. They're called papancha dhammas. Tanha, so tanha as desire, or unskillful desire, ditti and mana, so that desire, views, conceit, and those conceits. So those are things that complicate the mind, proliferate the mind, and create problems for us. So that those fixed views in terms of holding to a view, and oftentimes the views are ways, they're an expression of self where we can, what we tend to do is pick a view and then we lift ourselves up and put down somebody else, something else. And that, of course, it's agitating for the mind to do that. But we don't notice it because we've got, our view is fixed. And of course, if we're going to the effort of fixing it, we're obviously right. That's how it feels. And therein lies the problem. And then conceit is from a Buddhist perspective, they use the word differently than in the English language. As usually, conceit is an inflated view of oneself in compared to somebody else. But conceit from the Buddhist perspective is picking up any kind of self-perception, in a sense, in comparison to others, so that when the Buddha points to 9 different types of conceit, it's being as a being inferior and assuming oneself to be inferior, being inferior and assuming oneself to be equal, being inferior, assuming oneself to be superior, being equal, assuming oneself to be inferior, being equal, assuming oneself to be equal, being equal, assuming oneself to be superior, being superior, assuming oneself to be inferior, being superior, assuming oneself to be equal, being superior, assuming oneself to be superior. Any place that you put yourself on that spectrum in comparison to others is what the Buddha calls conceit, and it leads to dukkha. Just having to conceive oneself in comparison to others is already complicating the mind. It's proliferating the mind, complicating the mind, adding an extra burden that really didn't need to be there in the first place. So it's a really interesting perspective, because you think, wow, if that's the case, what do I think about now? It puts us back to experience. We tend to compare ourselves, and especially in a competitive society like America, there's a tremendous amount of comparing. So that just being able to see that as a papancha dhamma, as a complicating quality in the mind that is going to lead to dukkha. You mentioned ne kamma early in the retreat. It stuck with me and has been most useful. Renouncing expectations and desires in the retreat. It seems to be the antidote to craving, wanting. Where else is it used in the Dhamma? That's a definitely is an antidote to craving. Nekamma is seen as one of the baramis, and in Theravada tradition, there are 10 baramis. These wholesome virtues that we can cultivate and that are form the basis for us crossing over from, say, dukkha to peace, to knowledge, to liberation. Another place that comes up is in the Eightfold Path, say, when we think of right view, right sankappa, so right thought, right intention, right volition, so that and that's the first ne kamma sankappa, so that the thoughts of, say, it's the antidote to greed, so that the in say the in the say wrong thought, wrong intention is on the in the realm of can't remember how there's I'm trying to remember what the say in wrong it isn't here. This is the Eightfold Path, or right? I would just assume thoughts of sensuality, say kama sankapa as wrong, wrong intention, wrong thought. But that's the say in terms of the Eightfold Path on the sort of the things to be cultivating, ne kama sankapa also. Say abhayabhada sankapa, which is intention of non-ill will, and avihimsa sankapa, the intention of non-harming. So that sense of non-ill will is like metta. Avihimsa forms the basis of compassion, so renunciation, loving kindness and compassion. Would you have some suggestions on working with shame? As an emotion, it feels very sticky and probably the hardest one for me to work with. It seems like it is deeply rooted in my mind, probably thanks to Christianity. Is it true that Thai people have an easier time with it than Westerners? Is antidote to shame self-compassion? Yeah, I mean, certainly the that quality of shame. I mean, it works with it's kind of shame, guilt. They work together, slightly different, but that feeling of having wrong, somehow wrong. I'm wrong. How could I have been wrong? Why did I do it wrong? Those qualities of, as an antidote, certainly that self-compassion, a really internalizing that quality of loving kindness, so that like oftentimes, just from a Western mental standpoint, you know, it feels wrong to be sending and directing loving kindness to ourselves, because we shouldn't be doing that. So there's elements of belief and assumption in culturally held and culturally conditioned. And those aspects of loving kindness and compassion have a huge role to play in undermining that. And also, just the sense of self. I mean, we carry around that sense of me, a sense of I, and it's so firmly entrenched in how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to the world around us, and and tremendously burdensome. So that being able to just that relinquishing and releasing around the whole self concept, and how heavily we carry that. That there's a an important part of being able to relinquish the kind of attendant feelings of say shame or guilt that we carry. So those are it works together. Okay. Would you please speak a little bit more about "quote unquote mindfulness," and the sati factor. Since it seems to me that most, if not all, things register in consciousness. For example, discursive thoughts are registered in consciousness just as thoughts, and we are aware of the thoughts themselves. What distinguishes mindfulness from lack of mindfulness during this process? Maybe I'll talk a bit more about mindfulness in the sense that I think what we assume to be mindfulness, I think it's really helpful to recognize that when the Buddha spoke about mindfulness, there was a cluster of qualities that he spoke about. So like in the and it comes up in many, many places, but particularly in the say the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. But then, of course, there's many, many places through the suttas where this is referenced. The Buddha's description of the establishings of mindfulness have qualities that support each other. And in the say in the Pali language, Ata Bisambhajana Satima Vinaya Lokeya Bichato Manasa. It's the four particular qualities. So atapi, I'd say Ajahn Jeffrey usually translates that as ardent, but what it refers to is effort and a directing of effort, a directing of a certain energy, and in the Thai language, when it's translated, sort of the effort to say for the burning up of defilements, burning, because that word atapi is within that there's a tapas is say in the Hindu tradition, then those are practices for burning up. And in the Buddhist tradition, and there are actually mental states that were, but it still has that quality of just putting forth effort. So ardent is actually a really good word too. It's not just passive attention or passive kind of bare awareness sort of thing. Okay, you're engaging. You're ardent. You're not just kicking back and hoping for the best with mindfulness. There needs to be some effort applied, just given the nature of the mind. It needs some guidance. Sampajahano is, let's say, clear comprehension. Is one of the most common translations, and clear comprehension is in the Visuddhimagga, as a commentarial text. They speak of clear comprehension as another, or sampajanya, as another word for discernment. So it's like it's applying discernment. There's a part of mindfulness is being able to apply discernment as well. There's a reflection. So that part of discernment is knowing, being able to discern, say, right time and place, the right occasion, the right tool for the job in terms of okay, what's the situation that I'm in? What are the people that I'm with? What am I trying to accomplish? What's my goal even? So that there's some, you know, there's some considered reflection that's happening in order to be mindful. It isn't just some global, nebulous sort of mindfulness thingy. This is something one is, it's a quality of mind that one's working with and assessing. Is it working? Is it not working? Is part of, say, clear comprehension is, yeah, is it working? Is this even useful? Am I directing attention in a skillful way? And then the satima means sort of possessed of mindfulness, or possessed of awareness. One of the best definitions of sati or of mindfulness that I like, particularly like, is a definition by a Thai monk, Prapa Yutto. He's a wonderful scholar, practitioner, wonderful being. He said, mindfulness is that quality of the mind that draws the objects of the senses into the heart. So it's like we feel it, we experience it. That's what mindfulness is doing. And the last quality of, say, of mindfulness is sort of, mindfulness is also that which leads one out of the desire and dejection toward the world. Sort of the entangling qualities of mind that where we get caught in liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting, and mindfulness has the function of pulling us out of that and getting allowing us to not get caught in that tendency to spit, oh, I like that, no, don't like that, sort of like no, this is it's like this. I love that. That's a refrain that Ajahn Sumedho uses. It's like this. And I say, okay, you're mindful, you're present, you're clear, you're discerning. It's like this. And then when you're really present with that, then you can make some clear choices. Okay. Okay, I have a moral dilemma to ask you about. Someone I know, let's call him quote-unquote Henry, who is also a Buddhist, recently went to the pet store and saw this bearded dragon lizard, which he felt sorry for, so he bought and brought home. Normally this would be a good thing, since it was Henry's intention to simply take care of the lizard and give it a good home, since the lizard looked sad and miserable at the pet store. I think there's some projection happening here. Unfortunately, the lizard's diet requires that he be fed live baby crickets for his protein needs. Apparently, lizards can't eat dead things and need some protein for their normal growth. I told Henry that this is really bad, especially for Henry's karma and the poor crickets. So I told Henry to set the lizard into the wild and let it survive on its own. Henry says that according to his research, 90% of lizards bred in captivity die in the wild, so Henry cannot in good conscience set the lizard into the wild, basically giving him a death sentence, which Henry does not want, since he cares for the lizard. I then told Henry to give the lizard away to another family, and Henry says, well, that this will also cause someone else to have bad karma, since the lizard's dietary needs will be the same. So what to do in this case? There seems to be no good solution. Would you please comment? And if possible, I would like to have feedback from the other bhikkhus as well. I'd like their perspective, karma, intention, whose well-being does one pick when there is a conflict? It seems, and it is, I mean, it is an important question. It seems an important, that's why Abhayagiri has a very strict policy: no pets. That's really, people sort of they want to. You have these answers, yeah, because it does. It gets complicated, and you end up there are these dilemmas that are kind of are real, but that's in terms of say like kamma, the Buddha makes a very important distinction in the sense of kamma being grounded in volition, in intention, so the repercussions come from the volition behind it, and of course that doesn't make that less complicating, but it is important to recognize that there are distinctions. And it's nuanced, so that oftentimes feeling sorry for something that one acts on a intention of compassion, and all of a sudden it gets it ends up running your whole life, there is and we have to make. I think one of the things that's really important is that we're paying attention to how to take responsibility for our actions, because oftentimes we just act on an intention. It seems like a good, it seemed like a good idea at the time. can get really messy, and to be able to reckon, yeah, there are repercussions to our actions, and there are results that inevitably arise. So it's just being able to reckon, because that's what the word karma, and in the Pali, kamma, both of them, all that is simply the verb to do. That's all it is. So that we do something, then there is a result. And that's a kamma, and kamma vipaka. Vipaka is the result of kamma. So that there's an action, and there's a result, and it ends up being very complicated sometimes, and that's why application of discernment and understanding our volition and recognizing, yeah, there are results, so paying attention. How would you describe romantic love? And how do you know if it is real or wishful thinking? I think you're asking the wrong person. Talk about, to go back to the previous question, how things get complicated. obviously that's the world moves around, and that aspect of romantic love forms a large part of human interrelation and relationships. And one of the things in terms of being able to sort out what's real or wishful thinking is, you know, how much of it is concerned about me. Because that's when it gets messy and complicated and painful. To be able to experience, the emotions of love and not make it all about oneself, then that forms a good basis for a romantic involvement or long-term relationship. That's one of the things, like when the Buddha pointed to what is it that allows for a marriage to be, say, successful and to be mutually supportive, nourishing, and the Buddha pointed, people have to have mutual qualities that they're relying on, so that they have the same things that they have faith or confidence in. They have a same or similar quality of virtue, appreciation for virtue, have the same or similar appreciation for generosity and giving and sharing, and the same or similar appreciation or resonance in the qualities of discernment and understanding, so that those are qualities that draw, mutually support each other. We got another question. How do I deal with the mind which loves someone who doesn't love back? The heart, mind, and the brain are very hard to function normally. The thought of their suffering is overwhelming in the entire of their daily routines. I'm not really the best person to... it's... Because my... cut your losses and forget it. Not very romantic. It's just, why bother? But that's a monk's answer. It's not very touchy-feely. But I think it's helpful to have a perspective that sense of, what do we invest in? What do we hope for? What do we want? And what are we giving our time and our energy to? It's really important. These are important questions to be asking ourselves, whether it's in the relationship realm or whether it's in the realm of career or whether it's a realm of what we actually... what we do, what's important to us. So those are important questions to be asking and clarifying. It's one of the things that the Buddha, there's 10 reflections for monastics that we're supposed to be recollecting on a regular basis. And one of them is, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? And that's it's a really important question in terms of, who, what am I doing? Who am I associating with? What things am I doing? And is it actually nourishing me? And it's not a selfish obsession. And sort of, it's a very practical way to live as a human being, and then be a benefit to oneself, so that one can be a benefit to others as well. I'm wondering if you could talk about a spiritual bypass. What is it? How do you know if you've done one? How do you untangle from it? So a spiritual bypass is when we use a spiritual ideal to avoid kind of real or difficult choices or things. It's like the old story of from Ajahn Chah and the monk who Ajahn Chah finds is after going around checking the dwelling places in the monastery, and says one of the cabins, Kutis, in the forest, the roof is half missing, and go to the next evening meeting, was walking around, just relates that to the community, was walking around, there's one of the cabins, it's over in such and such a place, who's it belong to? And this monk said, oh, it's mine. And do you not notice that half your roof was missing? I said, yes. I said, what's the purpose behind this? Said, well, I'm practicing letting go. I said, you've been teaching us to let go. So it's like, the roof blows off, and it's so much effort to go and fix it or ask somebody to fix it. I'll stay under this part where there's still some roof. That's a spiritual bypass. using a spiritual kind of logic and to not bother with something that should be done. And of course that applies in all sorts of different ways. So experiencing some difficulty or something, and difficult relationships or difficulty, some conflict, it's all not self anyway, so, rather than being honest and paying attention to how do I work with this, how does this work, what's an appropriate way of dealing, then one uses sort of some kind of spiritual logic to not have to deal with it. That's a spiritual bypass. And I think one of the... because it's a view that one has bought into, one always internally has to pay attention to, where am I feeling some kind of dis-ease, some difficulty, some complication, some problem. But sometimes when one's holding a view, one can override reality. So this is where it's really important to have good spiritual friendships, where one has a network of either example of seeing other people, how they deal with things, and say, oh, that's a good example. That's a lot more functional than what I've been doing. Or having good spiritual friendships where people are able and there's enough trust to sort of say, you know, I think you really missed the plot on this one. And it's not, you know, it can be heard because it is a trusted spiritual friend. And so that sense of, you know, with a spiritual bypass or things like that, this is where one recognizes how important the Buddha's teaching on spiritual friendship, on having good spiritual friends, because you know, there's some things we don't see, or we don't see the whole picture, or we don't, or where, you know, it's too uncomfortable to see. So that having that network of support is essential. I remember reading some stories of Ajahn Chah teaching lay people herbal medicines. I know some Tibetan monks practice medicine. Is there such tradition in Thailand? Are there any stories of Ajahn Chah healing people physically with traditional medicines? Ajahn Chah was very knowledgeable of herbal medicines. He was very knowledgeable of the uses of different herbs and plants and leaves and trees and roots. And it used to be really fun to walk around the forest with Ajahn Chah, and if you got him going, you're just asking a couple questions. But what's this for? Can it be used for something? And then if you showed an interest, then he would start pointing out the uses of different. So he was very knowledgeable, and that was not uncommon at all in especially the forest monks of former generations. There weren't any doctors, there weren't any hospitals. Like when Ajahn Chah was growing up, Ubon had a hospital, and I think it was the first hospital in the northeast of Thailand. It's about a third of the population of Thailand. And then when he, you know, even when I was first got there, there was probably three, maybe hospitals in the northeast of Thailand: Khon Kaen, Udon, Ubon. And you go there and you just wait forever. it's just the way it is. When he was growing up, they were, you know, just going into town as a village person, that was a big deal. So that you grow up learning these things and these skills, and he wouldn't practice medicine per se. He would look after, say, the monks at where he was living with, and especially, in the Vinaya, the monks' discipline, there's rules against practicing medicine, and the Buddha's really keeping it as the vocation of the monastic is an alms mendicant. And one doesn't, say, earn one's living by being a doctor. One earns one's living by walking with an alms bowl. But it doesn't mean that one doesn't have knowledge and in appropriate circumstances doesn't pass it on. An example of that is he was one of the kind of head villagers in at the International Monastery. It's like in Wat Nanachan. And that village, there was many of the people from the village used to walk over to Ajahn Chah's monastery. It's about 7 kilometers. Every lunar observance day, every week, walk over in the morning, offer food for the meal, take the precepts, listen to a Dhamma talk, practice meditation, and stay for the evening, do chanting, meditate, listen to a Dhamma talk at night, and then after morning puja was over, then walk back to their village. And so that there was this one person, his name Paam, he said, all these people are going over to Ajahn Chah. And he had a lot of doubt. He was a real doubter and incredibly stubborn. So he went and started asking Ajahn Chah all sorts of questions, and he had all sorts of doubts, and you know, how is it possible as a layperson to live in the world and follow these Buddhist teachings? It just seems impossible that you can keep the precepts and as a villager and as a farmer and actually he'd met him before and gone back and forth with different doubts and questions, and finally came one time and he's really going to sort of get an answer from Ajahn Chah. He said, you know, questions and arguing back and forth. It was like for about 3 days and 3 nights back and forth. I mean, that's seriously stubborn. And then he finally passed out. He just collapsed. And then Ajahn Chah, he put some these urns of water around him, and then sat meditating. And then when he woke up again, he sort of came to. Ajahn Chah was just sitting there peacefully, and he said, "Don't ever argue with monks." Don't do it again. So, but then he said, you know, if you really want to keep the precepts as a layperson, and you really want to put these teachings into life, I'll teach you how to be a herbal doctor. And he said, I've got lots of knowledge, I'll pass it on. Then that way you don't have to be raising animals or killing animals or hunting, because it's northeast of Thailand. The how it used to be in the old days is that you would you'd plant a rice crop, you'd have a small little garden at your near your house, where you'd have some chilies and some garlic and a few herbs, and then everything else you collected from the forest, vegetables, or you hunted, trapped, shot with some thing or other. anything that moved basically was fair game. So it's more like a hunter-gatherer type ethos, and so it was a big deal to not. There wasn't a market economy. There wasn't anything like that. So that Ajahn Chah So he did. He trained him how to, in his knowledge. And then when, of course, he'd been around for quite some time, and when I went to Wat Nanachat, early days, the beginnings of Wat Nanachat, then he was well known as a, one, as a person who kept precepts, and two, he was he would get in as a say a herbal doctor. He would be invited to different villages, and he was also he usually would ask for the precepts on lead the lay community and asking for the precepts and leading the chanting on the lunar observance days. So he was a very upright upright person. And it was Ajahn Chah who taught him how to do that. You know, there's sometimes Ajahn Chah would give advice to us in, as monastics of different ways of treating illnesses, and you know, he was quite quite knowledgeable, quite skilled. That was the last question.